This is episode 3 of IDRA Class Notes.
What's universal in all our work with families across the board is all of them want their kids to do well. All of them want schools to prepare them for college. All of them have tremendous dreams. They might not know how to get there. And when you tap into that, you're tapping into a power way beyond, you know, teaching a parent how to be a better disciplinarian at home or how to do the homework. So that our work, even though obviously in working in parent and family involvement, there's a lot of parenting issues, and we do sometimes do those workshops, we need to fill that gap there is there that about families and leadership and education.
Good afternoon. You are listening to IDRA's Class Notes podcast, and I am Dr. Bradley Scott. I want to welcome you to the podcast this afternoon. These podcasts are designed to be a tool for public school teachers and administrators, as well as to provide insights into key issues in education in the United States. Now, IDRA is a private nonprofit company that has been in existence for more than 30 years. It is a small company with a big mission. The mission is to improve educational access for all kids, irrespective of their race, their color, their economic circumstance, but to ensure that schools work for all children. So, as I said, a small organization with a very, very big charge. As you are listening to this podcast, we are going to ask you to keep in mind that you can certainly send us your feedback. Our executive director, Dr. Maria Cuca Robledo Montesel, would be glad to hear from you, and we would be glad to get any feedback. You can send us your feedback by email to podcast@idra.org, or you may fill out the form on our podcast website or webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts. Let me say that again, www.idra.org/podcasts. We would love to hear from you. And by the way, you should feel free to subscribe. Our subscriptions are free of charge, and you can get those through Icon, the iTunes icon on our website, or other podcast directories. And we would love to have you subscribe and to send us any feedback or comments that you might have. Now, today we have a very important and exciting topic. We are going to be looking at the four dimensions of IDRA's parent engagement model with Mr. Aurelio Montemayor. It is a model that we think has great possibilities for people who truly want to engage parents significantly in the educational process of their children. Aurelio is what we call here at IDRA one of the IDRA lead trainer, and he is also the director of our newly refunded Parent Information and Resource Center. We are truly excited to have him here today. He's quite an expert in this field, has a long history of our organizational involvement in parental involvement and parental engagement activities. He has worked with all kinds of diverse populations. I am proud to say that he also sits on the National Board of the Parent Teacher Association, and we are excited because of the insights and the expertise that he will bring to this prestigious and important body. He brings extensive experience in working with school personnel, parents, and students, and his career in education expands 4 decades of brilliant work and contribution, including teaching at the high school level and the middle school level and elementary school levels. So he has certainly seen education from its many different faces. He received his bachelor's degree in English and philosophy from St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas, and a master's degree in bilingual education from Antioch Graduate School of Education in Ohio. He is passionate about the power that parents and communities can bring to the process of schooling and public education when they are engaged in leadership development and in creating effective educational experiences for all learners. And he is a key developer of our model for parental engagement and in helping schools, parents, and community groups rethink how they work together. Because this topic is so important in this day and age, as we are implementing No Child Left Behind, and that piece of legislation clearly sees the important, necessary role that parents must play in the process of successful schooling for children, we've asked Aurelio to spend some time talking about this model. And before you actually get into the model, Aurelio, I just want to welcome you this afternoon to the podcast. I do want you, if you would, just take a moment or so and talk about this evolution that we have seen around parental involvement, to participation, to engagement, and it seems as if we're moving to something even more significant and more complex than that. And if you would take a moment and use that as a backdrop and a foundation for your comments, I think not only I, but our listeners would appreciate it as well.
Thank you, Dr. Scott. As you said, IDRA has been around for over 30 years, and our focus is children and schools. We want schools to work for all children. It's really clear that as you think of the child, you think of their first teachers and their most powerful advocates, their parents. So our family involvement is a key piece. Historically, we know that the people that most love the children, that most want them to succeed, are their parents, their families. And so we see that as a very important piece in our work in terms of making schools work for all children. Now, historically, I guess through federal legislation and Title I, many years ago, they start schools that were receiving federal monies, whether there was a state mandate or not, had to start focusing on the participation of parents. What we saw over time, though, was there was a minimal or a surface involvement. And we also, in terms of our concerns, especially about the children that need the most support, children that are poor, minority, or speak a language other than English, who need a lot of support, we saw those families that were ones that were least reached out to, or the ones least engaged, at least in the formal process of the educational system. We also have seen historically that for any parent and families, parenting is a very important issue of all classes, races, and groups. And we also know that there's a huge parenting market out there that's based on pushing the guilt button. No family feels perfect, no matter what their color, class, or race is. And so there are good materials out there, but a concern I have is that we start from something broken or what is needed. And of course, parents will readily say, yes, what can I do? I need more help. I'm not the perfect parent. So as we saw the evolution of parent involvement in the schools through mandate and through need, we also saw that just like with children, we need to value their language and culture and who they are exactly as they are, rather than looking at what's missing. We also needed to look at it in families. We needed to start from where families are, what they have, and mapping their assets. The literature is full of deficit model descriptions of children are failing because of their parents. The parents are poor. They don't know how to read. Somehow they don't know how to rear children. And I know that families aren't perfect, but it's a deficit notion to start from. And we know when you start with that notion with children, it's very hard to be a good teacher to them. If I don't expect children to learn, or at least I see them as somebody that's broken, a child that has the wrong culture, the wrong language, comes from a single parent. In other words, I start from thinking of what the child doesn't have, and that's not an effective place or a good place for a teacher to start from. Parallel to that with parents, we need to start from where they are. And so about 20 years ago, a little bit over 20 years ago, Dr. Montesel and I sat down. I had had the privilege for many years of leading within IDRA different kinds of parent work, parent training, parent leadership development. And she said, as schools are being now put under greater pressure through accountability, and disaggregating scores of children is not bad, but nevertheless, the schools that most need help are under the greatest trouble. We also need to see how parents go beyond being seen as a volunteer, as a cheap labor pool, and certainly go beyond the point so that if a family is not middle class, a family is not white, if a family is not an English-speaking family, they also have tremendous riches to bring to the school. And how can we look at that? And also, how can we see the leadership emerge from the families that most need schools to work for them? So out of all that, we decided about 10 years ago to put into place a model that had been kind of emerging in the field. It was out there in our work, and so we call it valued parent leadership. The word valued to right away announced to the world that our notion is that all families are valuable and none is expendable. I mean, you value them. If it's an urban African-American family, I'm not going to want to see anything, but here are a valued set of people, adults, that in some cases economically are hanging on by their fingernails, and I need to laud that. I need to say, thank God you're there for those children. How can I support you in that? And I know that you want your kid to get a good education. Because what's universal in all our work with families across the board is all of them want their kids to do well. All of them want schools to prepare them for college. All of them have tremendous dreams. They might not know how to get there. And when you tap into that, you're tapping into a power way beyond, you know, teaching a parent how to be a better disciplinarian at home or how to do the homework. So that our work, even though obviously in working in parent and family involvement, there's a lot of parenting issues, and we do sometimes do those workshops, we need to fill that gap there about families and leadership and education.
So, Aurelio, if I'm understanding you, before you get too deeply into the model, one, are you suggesting that this model does in fact respond to some of those deficit views about parental involvement and engagement? Certainly it fills that void, not around parent skills in terms of the home, but parents' engagement and in connection with the school and what happens to their children in the school. And that this model, I also think, would provide a greater way for allowing diverse parents and those who have been most underserved in terms of their involvement, real significant involvement in the public school setting, to be significantly engaged. So is my understanding correct that this model begins to speak to those issues and more?
Absolutely, Bradley. One of the things that all of us are aware of, I grew up, you know, in a blue-collar home, Spanish-speaking, and I know that those of us that have had the blessing to get an education and get degrees somehow sometimes distance ourselves from where we came from. And one of the things that, I mean, I heard it this weekend in a tremendous meeting in terms of developing diversity in leadership at the PTA and stuff like that. You know, there's this unaware, a person stood up and asked me, well, you know, I call these meetings, we had door prizes, and very few showed up. We had to give the door prizes to the teachers in the school because no parents showed up. It's like a broken record we hear, and it's like the school has its process. We set up a meeting, we invite the parents, they don't show up. See, again, I told you, they don't care. In other words, if we keep doing that, it's still going to get the same results. Part of it is parents stop showing up or don't show up if they're demeaned or looked down upon, if the language is not understandable, if there's a clique within the school that happen to be parents, but they're gatekeepers who are there to exclude the parents that don't look right, don't talk right, don't know Robert's Rules of Order, whatever. That's already one huge barrier. Beyond that, parents who are working two jobs, hanging on by their fingernails, we have to have other structures and other ways because they really care about those kids. We just need to figure out different ways to connect with them and have them share with us what they know about their children. That's their greatest resource a parent has, is every parent is an expert in his or her child. They don't need a degree, and a degree would get in the way. Because even if you had a PhD in child development, when you have your first child, it goes out the window. You just start from scratch, and when you have your second child, it's like the first one, you tell me what you thought you learned. In other words, all the world, families, for the most part, learn how to be parents from what is transmitted from their parents and what they learn on the spot. And I don't think any nation is trying to formally, before anybody becomes a parent, train them to be parents. That's just not something that's in the works anywhere. So I have to then acknowledge and say, I know you care about your child and you want that child well educated. Now, how can I within the school connect with you?
That sounds like an excellent backdrop to your explanation of this model. Give us an idea of what it looks like then.
Okay. First of all, this parent leadership model, and some people get thrown off with the word leadership. They think, well, parents aren't ready for that. No, when we're saying leadership, we're expanding, we're stretching the definition. First of all, the context for this to work has to be inclusive. Everybody comes in. We reach out to everybody, expanding. It has to be based on peer support and rotating responsibilities. Whether you know Robert's Rules of Order or not, doesn't matter. It has to be an ongoing invitation and support for new leadership. It can't be this rhythm that you, I remember a parent about must have been about 20 years ago, I was doing parent training for parents whose children were in a bilingual program. And these were Spanish-dominant families, and it was our second meeting, and I asked, it was like October, how many of you have been contacted by school? And a lady said, este año no me han llamado, gracias a Dios. This year they haven't called me, thank the Lord. I mean, she was, the pattern is, in many schools, is a parent is contacted because something went wrong. Okay, this ongoing invitation then and support for new leadership has to be, first of all, about how thankful we are this child is with us. And telling the parent what the child's strengths are. And validating the strength of, let's say it's a housewife, how many meals she's cooked, how many diapers she changed, how many nights she stayed awake all night because the kid was sick. Not just acknowledging, kissing the ground that woman walks on, because it's all this, all these families with no special support from anybody rearing these families.
So it's a validation of them. Validating, that's wonderful.
Validating. It has to be focused on collective action, because the other thing that concerns us about a leadership model is the one that speaks the loudest, the one that's most assertive, becomes the leader. And there's nothing wrong with that, but what we need is large numbers of families coming to the front. And some people are leaders by connecting other families, by going and inviting their neighbors. Others are leaders because they watch what's going on and see who's excluded and make sure that person comes in. We need to really, really say this is a group of families with compassion for each other, understanding that their vision is the same. Whatever their background in terms of race, color, or creed, their vision is that the children in this school accomplish. And that's what unites us. And so the leadership has to do with collective action in the sense that as a group, we're going to get doing something. If you can draw well, you draw the poster. I'll cook and stuff like that. But that doesn't mean that if I cook, I never am the leader and think for the group. In other words, like there has to be that rotation. Building relationships of trust and compassion are essential to this process. I'm not talking about a leadership that's based on the charisma and strength of one individual, because we've also seen that the parents that are like that burn out, and then there's nobody left. And so that we see in the history of parent involvement in education, because the children move from grade to grade, parents tend to move along. And so once the child is no longer in school, those people are no longer participating with leadership in education. What we're going to see is the whole community take it on. So that's the basis of the model. We have four dimensions, and I might want to first acknowledge that over the last 15 to 20 years, the research in parent involvement has hit a new high.
Sure it has. Is it?
And you know, we have people, for example, like Dr. Joyce L. Epstein. She's at the Center on School, Family, and Community Partnerships at Johns Hopkins, leading researcher, trying to bring some sense to this whole field, because it's just starting to penetrate the training of teachers and administrators, where colleges prepare educators are starting to say, and this is an important thing. It's not just parent involvement, it's school, family, and community partnerships. And there have to be courses that prepare educators for it, because that's something that you just learn when you get to the campus, basically. So those researchers are very important. Ann Henderson, a key researcher.
Well known.
Yeah. She's got a new wave of evidence, Beyond the Bake Sale. Again, these are people that are very, very intelligent. They're academic. They're also very practical. And they're pulling the field together. Because the other thing is that in education, you have to have the research and the data. And it's out there. You know, I didn't need it 30 years ago, but we need it out there so schools understand that if they want to save public education, there has to be a partnership with families. Those are the strongest potential advocates for keeping that neighborhood public school open and being the excellent school it has to be.
Excellent point.
Yeah. Okay, now the other piece is that when IDRA developed its dimensions or types of parent leadership or parent involvement, and I keep using the word leadership because I want to, it's so important that we don't say just parenting or homework done. We're talking about leadership at any level. We created four dimensions. Dr. Epstein's types of parent involvement are excellent. Those six levels are from the point of view of the institution. The first one is parenting. The institution has a responsibility to support parents and how parents can be better parents. Communicating, because schools historically have not communicated well with families, so that's an important key. Volunteering, because a lot of parents, their role is as volunteers. Learning at home, decision-making, collaborating with the community. Those are the six keys. Well, IDRA's four dimensions start from our work and from the perspective of the family, from the parent. So the first connection that a parent has is the parent as a first teacher. You have the child, or whoever's rearing the child, if it's the grandmother, the uncle, whoever, you are the first teacher for that child. Where the child picks up language, values, large and small muscles, skills, all that stuff happens in the first 3, 4, 5 years. And most of that is spent around the major caretakers. So it might not be the mother, because we know that grandmothers and even great-grandmothers now are rearing children. But whoever that is, we have to acknowledge, regardless of class, race, education, or anything else, that is the child's first teacher, and we need to validate it. What we see in our work, in our workshops, in our contact is, we don't see ourselves as we're transmitting information and teaching what is not known, but starting by validating what the person already brings, regardless of literacy level or class or race. So that first dimension is where you have families come together and share why they love their children, what they do at home, how they talk with their children. And it's not to judge, but simply to hear. Because we're also talking about large numbers of families that are not heard. They are questioned, they're invited to meetings, they're taught things, they're taught instructions and rules, but we're saying we're starting from a deep listening of these families. And that's that first dimension, parent as teacher. When the child goes to school or the institution, whether it's Head Start or the public school, then the parent is a resource to that institution. And again, our first level of resources has nothing to do with being cheap labor pool to raise money. There's nothing wrong with that. And I mean, obviously the history of many parent-teacher organizations is about raising money because we need curtains for the stage. Nothing wrong with that. But I would put that at level 6 or 7. I want to start, first of all, saying, Dr. Scott, your 5-year-old is in my school. What is he like? What is your child like? Tell me about him. What are his strengths? How does he like to learn? What makes him sad? What makes him happy? And no parent can ignore that question, and no parent is empty of information.
So that becomes that valuable resource of information about the child.
If I am teaching 15 of these darlings, I want 15 caretakers to tell me what is each one of these children. Because you know that even if you have identical twins, they're going to be different.
Critically important.
Yes. And again, I'm validating the intelligence of the parent, regardless of background. In fact, in spite of background. Okay? And so then that's the first and key resource that you are to the school. Then you're also a resource because you want a safe school, and you can certainly collaborate with this campus to make it safer. As a person who's very wise in raising children, regardless of training, okay? Again, when we take the word resource, I want to flip it, because the traditional notion is parent as volunteer. We're going to have a field trip, so here we need a chaperone.
Sure, sure.
There's nothing wrong with that. Or please help us decorate poster boards that we're going to put in the hallways people come in. Parents are great for that, and some parents, in fact, love that. But I want to keep shifting it, because here I'm trying to see how do we unlock that brilliance of all these blue-collar mothers that know a lot, and they themselves don't think they know it? Because there's where the power to strengthen this camp is going to come. These mothers and fathers care about the children. They want this school to be good. They might not be able to write a curriculum textbook, and we don't want them to. That's somebody else's job. But they are a resource in many, many areas. Let's say safety. Right now, when the media hits about all the dangerous things happening in schools, imagine how many of these parents wouldn't love to have some say-so and some part of making their school safe.
Absolutely.
For their children. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so any committee, any site-based decision-making committee, a lot of times some of these parents are excluded or thought they're not good material because they don't understand how a meeting is run. Well, we can always adapt our language, because the issue is safety on this campus. They know children. They know the ideas of safety. They know how this neighborhood runs, and they can give us a lot of information, because it just so happens, for example, in a lot of schools, certainly in urban schools, the teaching staff doesn't live even close to that campus. The ones that live closest to that campus will be the ones that are going to be the strongest resource as to what's going to make this community and this school safe. And so, again, parent is resource, but it's not, I really want to move away from the resource. Now, don't get me wrong, some of these parents will and want to raise money for the school. And they feel they can do that well.
But clearly, it means that they can do more than that.
A lot more. A lot more.
And it should be tapped to do more.
Exactly. Now, I've noticed, for example, in certain suburban schools, the parent organizations that have doctors and lawyers on them, the schools wouldn't dare look down on those parents in any way. And in fact, they're grateful if Dr. So-and-so, whose child is on the campus, gives some time to the meeting and you go out of your way. Why? Because this is a high-level professional. And now I'm a professional, you're a professional, so I'm not putting down professions, but I don't think that I should be much more valuable to that campus than Don Juan, who's a carpenter, or Doña Chole, who's a housewife, yes. And that's her main role, because they bring a lot. They bring a lot. And I want to crack that notion that there's something better as a human being because I've got a degree. And I'm not at all embarrassed by my degrees. I was the first one to get a degree in my extended family. I'm proud of it. I want every kid possibly to get a degree, but I don't want to continue this notion that this makes me somehow a superior human being. You know, because working with your hands has a lot of dignity. Sad that they don't pay much money for it, but that there's dignity in mopping a floor.
I think that's a point well made.
Yes. Okay, so that's parents as resources. We're going from parents as teachers to parents as resources. Third dimension, parents as decision makers. Now, all schools have committees. And obviously there are officers in PTAs and PTOs. There's advisory committees. But we've seen a pattern in some schools, certainly in terms of Title I and then in bilingual ed, Title III, what was called Title VII before, where you become, there's a small group of selected parents who are the rubber stamp committee for almost every decision. And I think what we need is some bona fide participation. And we don't have to think that we're going to have to send them to go through a year of training to become a decision maker. Because again, if we look at the experience of families, think of a family who's on minimum wage. They're rearing five kids. The dad is the only wage earner in the house. And the mom has to take 50 or 100 bucks and figure out how to feed that family all week. There are a complex set of decisions that mother is making every moment. In August, when they have to buy clothes for the kids, they're very complex and difficult decisions in terms of how much do I spend on the shirts and pants and shoes for these kids as the kids are asking for name labeled on stuff. You know, in other words, like every day, families are making very complex decisions, but when it comes to school as decision making, we're saying, oh no, they just don't have those experiences. Well, what we need to learn is how do we set up our meetings and do our planning so that their decision making skills come to bear? Because obviously in terms of economics, families that are hanging on by their fingernails are making very complex decisions. Now that doesn't mean that you sit them down and they can make decisions around the table on curriculum and stuff like that. No, it's that we bring together school and family in such a way that decisions are looked at in such a way that people can understand what's being decided upon. And in critical situations, families, any parent, any caretaker can sit around the table. Grandma can sit there and say, you know what? If we spend this much on books and this much on that, what about this? In other words, there's all kinds of stuff that families, whether it's advising the school on the new fence or the new playground, the size of rooms, what teachers need. Parents are naturally very compassionate with teachers.
So, Aurelio, it sounds as if you're saying it's not so much the parents don't know how to make decisions and very complex decisions, but that schools need to know how to tap into this tremendous capacity they have for making decisions and how to make that useful and applicable to the school context.
Absolutely. And I have been classroom teachers, Bradley, and you know that a lot of times what I'm fighting for is space in that room. I want flexible tables. And a lot of times the school budget of the school. But if I, as a teacher, sit down with parents and they know that as a high school English teacher, I'm teaching 150 kids every day. If I've got five periods of 30 kids each day, I'm teaching 150 of their children. And if some parents are sitting around, I'm saying, look, if you want them to learn Shakespeare, whatever the heck I'm teaching, I really would need this kind of space. They can tell the architect, they can sit with their parents and say, you know what, you know, really, you know, I've got three kids at home and I need a lot of space for them to move around. These teach, in other words, like parents can talk about many, many complex issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know, for example, I know that I found some parents that being my stronger advocates because I was being very creative in the classroom and the parents would come in and say, you know, you need more magazines. Let's do a magazine drive and stuff like that. All kinds of stuff. When the parents see a dilemma, and I'm saying this because sometimes we counterpose active parents as somehow being against the school. No, they don't want things to be bad in the classroom because I'm taking your child every day for a 50-minute period or a 90-minute period. They want me to do the best with their children, and they don't have a computer at home, so they want me to have computers for them. And if the principal says, well, we don't have enough in the budget, the parent will say, I'll go with you to the school board. I'll go with you, and we're going to get the computers we want because in this neighborhood, we don't have computers at home. We want them in the school.
Absolutely.
You know, and that kind of stuff. And so parents as decision makers are a wonderful opportunity for any school to see that, for example, on the issue of technology, we know right now the gap is largest between families that are poor and families that have enough to have the resources to have computers at home. So where is the point where you could equalize that in the school? So if the school budget in this campus is so limited that we can only have one computer in each classroom, these families could certainly unite around making sure that there's a computer lab and it's open evenings so they and their children come and use those
great
computers.
Idea. Yeah, great
right.
idea.
And again, so as decision makers, you know, any sharp principal, and like our friend Dr. Lopez in Houston at a high school, you know, man, his best partners are the parents. And it was through the parents that he was able to get large donations to that campus. Because, you know, it's really interesting because elected officials and politicians might tell an educator, well, you're just fighting for more salary, something for yourself. But when the parents and the students are next to that educator, they're not going to say much. In other words, because, again, parents are such strong advocates for the best for their kids. Okay? Now, up to now, I've talked about parents as teachers, resources, and decision makers. This is pretty much in a lot of the outlines. Where I think IDRA added a dimension as a basic dimension is parent as leader and trainer. Now remember, we are flipping a little bit the definition of leader. We're not saying leader just a PTA president or the head of a committee or somebody that runs for office or something like that. We're saying leaders essentially have to be people that care about all the children, not just their own, and care about other families. So listening to others and compassion is a key element. It's I can't say how important it is, because first of all, those are qualities that you can find in abundance among parents, even though they might be shy about talking in front of a group or be giving the label of a leader. But if they actively recruit other parents to become part of the family, a school partnership, they're already doing something that schools don't know how to do, and they complain honestly they don't know how to reach out to parents.
You also mentioned another point that I think is a quality, and it is that parents have a vision. They have a vision for their what they want for their children. They have a way of thinking about that, a way of hoping for that,
absolutely,
a way of desiring that. And because this model seems to give them a voice, they have a place in order to give that vision voice as they share it with educators and those who will be touching their children's life. So that seems, and clearly, having vision clearly is a leadership dimension as well.
Yeah, you can never forget that what's bringing these people together is not money, is not ego, it's that they all care about those children. And, you know, one of the ways, by the way, for example, because we deal with some audiences that have very little literacy, or certainly very little literacy in English, we use a lot of drawing. And a typical session starter is have each person around the table share what is your dream and your vision for your child and the other children on this campus. Then collectively they make a drawing of what they said. The drawings are put on the wall and then everybody walks around and hears the reports. And then I ask, what did you see in common? And inevitably saying, my God, we've all got the same dream. We've all got the same vision. And when you hear, you know, a group of poor whites, blacks, and Latinos in the room say this, you've just broken through generations of separation, because they instantly see what they have in common. And it was done in such a way that everybody could say their say, they were able to share, and even though the drawings seem childlike, there's nothing simple about it, and it's deep. It's deep. One of the things that schools don't teach and don't guide their outreach workers in is, how do you connect to the vision of these families? It's more, we're going to have a meeting, are you going to show up? It starts from a very different place. It's about common vision, it's about relationships. And so leadership has to be about that. Leadership has to be about, not that we got 30 people into the room or 100 people into the room, is how are we connecting, how are we forming a strong network of families that all are together because of their vision, and then how do we teach the others what we know? Because that peer instruction, I think, is very important thing that we see in leadership. We also want to be able to create communities of caring. And traditional leadership, let's say, if you become a leader because you got voted into a position and you identify policies and you do that kind of work, it kind of sometimes separates you from this human connection. And what we want to do is build in each community this network of families that care about their kids, and they say, oh, that's how I'm a leader. Because you can imagine, for example, a common response we get at schools about meetings is, well, you know, we've had 3 meetings and we had just 5 people show up at one of them. And we send out the notices in English and in Spanish, and, you know, and sometimes we even talk to the parents. And then I say, well, you know, Mrs. Garcia brought 10 people to the last meeting. And you say, this lady by herself not an employee, nothing else, was able to bring 10 people. Imagine the power that's out there to answer that one problem that schools have is that they hold events and parents don't show up. In other words, if you connect to the leadership of those natural, and you find them everywhere, people that are just people. They go and sit down and drink coffee in somebody's kitchen, and by the end of that conversation, she's got two more people to come to the meeting. And they're going because she invited them and because there's a connection. In other words, the other thing about how we see parent leadership is sometimes educators and the people that have the job of bringing parents forget how difficult and what it is to raise families. And when it's a parent from that school, and, you know, she can't forget because she's got the kids every day. I mean, her primary focus is they're going to be home after school. And I've got teenagers. And, you know, when you've got teenagers, you've got particular challenges. And so I think that the vision about the children plus the compassion for the daily trials and tribulations of being a parent are kept in place. They can offset the daily trials and tribulations of what it takes to educate children because schools are worried about the test scores and things like that, and you tend to forget the human being, the child, and the parent.
Well, it really seems to me then that these four dimensions of parental involvement and engagement become powerful on many more levels than just what each one of them would suggest alone. So in other words, there seems to be some kind of way that they not only become interconnected, but they also create a synergistic kind of presence. When you think about parents as the first teacher, parents as resource to the school about the child, parents as decision makers, and then this last powerful dimension, which is parents as leaders and as trainers of others. It's a powerful notion. I know our time is running short, but I did hear that you mentioned Dr. Lopez, and I think I agree with you, Aurelio. What he has been able to do in terms of engaging parents and children has been a powerful example of this at work, it seems to me. Are there places like that, other places that come to mind where you see this model working in this powerful way?
Well, I think...
Or could you make a quick comment example?
You find it more at the elementary level. There are schools around that have excellent leaders, educational leaders, principals, and educators that have a wonderful relationship with the community. You have them in El Paso area, at the Isleta Independent School District. You have them in South Texas. You have them in some places in Houston and Dallas. What I think is important is that where it's working well, first of all, one of the things that we contrast with typical parenting training and even most sessions that are done, let's say to teach parents about No Child Left Behind, it's information for you and your child. And so it's very individualistic. Everything we do, we move towards how can parents as a group support each other and support the school. Because what we need to do in a lot of these schools is accelerate the change in those schools so that there are really good places for those children.
All children.
And so we really avoid doing a lot of just individual, here, I want you to know the rules. And let's say I'm very aggressive in wanting to push the school to change, if I'm just telling individual parents that, as opposed to parents seeing themselves collectively and in partnership with the school, it's going to take a long time. And so we really are concerned not just about you and your child, but how you become really, as a parent, wanting all the children and all parents to be connected and supporting the best possible education these children can have.
Aurelio, listen, I really want to thank you for this overview of the engagement model. I cannot believe that we have spent nearly enough time being able to talk about each one of these, but I thank you for this very thorough overview and also for this interesting, different way of looking at the power that the parents can have in terms of their presence in support of schools that they work better for their children. I really hope that we have a chance to sit down again and have a continued conversation on this hugely important topic. And I want to say to all of our listeners that you should feel free to go to the IDRA website at www.idra.org to get information on parent engagement as well as many other topics around which we provide a wealth of information. I want to invite you also once again to be sure to give us your feedback by emailing us at podcast@idra.org or go to our website and visit visit with us, our webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts. Don't forget the S, podcasts. On behalf of Dr. Maria Cuca Roberto Monticello and the staff at the Intercultural Development Research Association, I want to thank you for being with us this afternoon, and we look forward to your being with us again on our very next podcast. Good afternoon.
Thank you for listening to IDRA Class Notes. For more information on IDRA and other Class Notes topics, go to www.idra.org. You can also send us your thoughts by email to podcast@idra.org or fill out the form on our podcast webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts.